Welcome to the Angaza Forum podcast, where we engage in dynamic conversations with industry leaders and trailblazers on the profound impact of the financial services sector in driving sustainable development and creating an equitable society. In this podcast series, we shine a spotlight on the vital role of women in the financial sector and their contributions to shaping a more inclusive and progressive financial sector. This podcast series complements our in-person convenings, which take place across Africa. Our next event will be held in Nairobi, Kenya this October 16th and 17th. To register, visit our website at angazaforums.com. My name is Patricia Kamau, and the topic for today is empowering Africa's future leaders. And we are happy to be joined by Yawa Hansen-Kwao, who is the founder of Leading Ladies Network. Yawa's passion for empowering future leaders is evident through her notable work at the International Strategy Forum and the Leading Ladies Network. These organizations focus on the critical issues such as ethics, gender parity, and inclusive governance, all of which are essential in empowering Africa's future leaders. By promoting ethical leadership, addressing gender disparities, and advocating for inclusive governance, Yawa contributes to the development of responsible and diverse leaders in Africa. Welcome, Yawa. We are so happy for you to join us today.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
So first of all, before we get started, I'd like to congratulate you and your team at Leading Ladies for celebrating 15 years. What an achievement.
Thank you. We are so thankful to the years of experience we have under our belt. We're thankful to all of the leading ladies that have said yes to an opportunity for us to unfold our leadership journeys together. We're thankful to our sponsors and partners that have enabled this work over the years. And I think it's just such a good moment for the organization to take stock and re-strategize and recalibrate, you know, so we're undergoing this massive process internally to really reposition the organization for its next 15 years. So it's an exciting time, and I'm just so thankful for this opportunity to have spearheaded work that has transformed the lives of thousands of women across Africa and around the world.
That sounds amazing. For those who may not have an understanding of the work that Leading Ladies Network does, could you please share an overview of your organization? How did Leading Ladies start, and what motivated its creation?
Sure. You know, I founded the Leading Ladies Network in 2009, and I was driven by a vision of a world in which women would be normalized as leaders. You know, part of my backstory is that formative years of my life were spent in the United States. My family were, you know, running away from the political upheaval of the military coup that ousted President Hilaire Mann in the early 80s. My father was involved in politics. It wasn't safe for us to remain here. So formative years of my life were spent in outside of my home country. So in a country where I think a lot of people look up to the United States as a beacon of hope and possibility, where immigrants have opportunities to make the most of themselves. And so I feel like I, as a multicultural African in that sense, I have a unique lens through which I look at everything, including leadership. And I had the great pleasure of running for and becoming the first woman to be president of my student government here in Ghana. And when I ran for president, I wasn't necessarily trying to prove a point. I just honestly felt I was the person with the best ideas and the vision and the drive to get things done. So I ran for and won with over 70% of the vote. It was a landslide victory. And it turned out it wasn't just in my university campus. It was the first time in the history of Ghana that a woman at any Ghanaian university had become president of her university's student government. And I was excited, but I was also quite ashamed. Like, wait, why had it taken so long for something this, you know, monumental to have happened? And that's where my attention started to turn towards women's leadership. Like, what are the barriers? I had always been interested in women's issues, but was mostly focused on women's health you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, and to in some countries to a certain extent now, HIV/AIDS was warping into a women's disease. I was very passionate about peer education. I was one of the ambassadors with the Ghana AIDS Commission, really helping to teach sexual reproductive behavior, you know, in a responsible manner to help curb the stem of HIV/AIDS infections among women. But when I became a public visible leader at my university campus, and all of the press was reporting that, wow, this was the first time in the history of Ghana that this had happened, my attention was drawn towards women's leadership. And that's where I started to formulate the ideas for the Leading Ladies Network. Like, what would it take to make sure that my achievement, although it was the first, wouldn't be the last? And how do we create an ecosystem of support that would enable women and girls with ambitions for more than just wife and motherhood to find the resources that would enhance their development as leaders? So that was the vision behind it. That's what spurred me on to start it. And I started it by just going back to what launched me, which was getting young girls to run for student government. You know, the statistics show that the earlier that young women say yes to public leadership, the more likely that they will become visible public leaders in the future. So we partner with junior high and high schools all over the country, and our team of mentors and volunteers really work to help strengthen confidence, build skills, and draw connections between young women and women at different stages of their transitions through life to ensure that wherever they are, they can confidently raise their hand for leadership. So to date, we've got over 12,000 success stories of young girls and women at different stages who have raised their hand for leadership, either running for prefectship at their school, running for president, running for some role in their local community, and beyond. And part of what has driven this work is the notion that, you know, women are already leaders. Our job is to help unearth the potential that they already possess and help create an architecture of support that enables them to dream big, raise the bar of their ambitions, and to work collaboratively with others to drive change. So that really has been the motivation. Over the 15 years of this work, you know, our work has centered in Ghana, but has also impacted women in Liberia, in Nigeria, in Kenya, and in other parts of Africa, but also increasingly the US and other countries. You know, I really, really believe in holistic development. And I believe that you know, understanding your power means that you have to first express leadership with self. Really, really accept yourself for who you are, play to your strengths. And I believe that passion is good, but strategy is better. So a lot of our programming is on how to help women and girls be more strategic about their life choices, so that they can really, really bring to bear the skills, the exposure, but also the ambitions that they have to drive change at whatever level they feel called to.
I like that you mentioned that passion is good, but strategy is better. And I feel like that's something a lot of us would relate to. So in the context of empowering this young future leader, why is addressing the issues of ethics, gender parity, and inclusive governance particularly crucial, especially at this time in the continent?
These are critical issues because of the unprecedented challenges that Africa faces. You know, at heart, I'm a teacher. At heart, I'm someone who feels very passionate about Africa reclaiming its position as an exemplar of socioeconomic progress and excellence. And no continent can succeed with only half of its human capital. And I think that's the real case for having more and more women and girls emerge into public leadership The state of our continent requires 100% of all of Africa's assets, human assets, to be deployed. And many women and girls are often systematically excluded. And I want to change that. I want to create a network of women that have both capability, but also seize opportunity to bring their skills into the public arena. And there's so much evidence to show that the more women emerge as leaders, the more they help change and shift systems that ordinarily overlook and exclude those that are ordinarily overlooked and excluded. So I really think that, you know, in a moment like this, where we've got technological advances just changing the game in every sector, we have issues around corruption really eroding the gains that many countries have made in democracy. We've got issues of economic decline, especially with many countries in Africa still reeling from the effects of COVID, you know. So we're in a state where we need massive post-COVID economic recovery. We need massive education in countries all over this continent. Illiteracy rates still hover above 50%. And all of these things need every hand on deck to solve. And I believe women are just by nature problem solvers. And I've always said, if you can get two kids to stop quarreling, you've essentially got that skill set that can be used to broker world peace. So we need to deploy more women who have these natural capabilities that the world is in dire need of at this moment. And our job, as I see it, or as founder of Leading Ladies, this is what I motivate my team with, that our job really isn't to teach people what to do, but to help them see that they've already got the skill set at an essential basis. And our job is to help amplify and help them raise the bar of their vision for themselves and their communities and just get out of their way so they can do it. Because women at heart are already problem solvers. We like to get things done. We're not the kind who will pontificate and overtalk an issue. We just do. And I think we've got lots of credibility doing that in the private sphere. And I think it's high time more of us say yes to doing this in more public spheres. I think that many nations need our voices in our economies, in our budget, in our defense, in our whatever sphere of life. Women's voices need it. And I want to fix that. And if we can get more women and girls to really, really own and hone their voices, I think it will make a big difference in how Africa leapfrogs over some of the major issues we're facing right now. One of the most optimistic statistics is that Africa does have the world's youngest population. And, you know, I am increasingly passionate about young women, especially because I think the work of women's leadership development must start when women are girls. It needs to start when they haven't yet made those life-altering decisions, like, will they marry? How many kids will they have? What career path? Before they even make life-altering choices, if we can find them and help them see their power, it will help set them up for a lifetime of leadership. And so much of our work really is at that grassroots level with young girls from resource-constrained communities who often are the first or the few women or girls in their community or in their families to go to school and to have an education. There's something about switching the lights on in women's lives early that really sets them up to make the right choices, those strategic choices that enable them to thrive as public leaders in the future. So we have, you know, a lot of programming and different curricula that really meet girls at that stage of adolescence, where the statistics show us that many girls face a confidence crisis in adolescence, that's where they start to self-doubt. That's where they start to listen to the media messaging that focuses and fixates them on their body and what they look like instead of, you know, what they know and what they can offer. So that's why I feel very passionate about working with girls. We have a really dynamic girls governance program that really exposes young girls, especially in election years like this year. We do a lot of work with girls that'll be voting for the first time to help them understand the great opportunity, but also the responsibility that comes with being a voter, that you have a say in how your country goes, and you want to use that responsibility and treat it as a sacred trust. We teach about governance, the three arms of government, and how things work so that you won't just have a generation of young people who are complaining, but who also know how to work the system to get things done. So I feel very privileged to get this opportunity to be part of the unfolding success stories of so many brilliant young women that are emerging into public leadership. And I feel that there's no greater joy in my life right now than to get to be a trusted voice and advisor to not just our beneficiaries, but the teams of supporters, volunteers, and mentors who help us to deliver this work.
Well, you mentioned cultural and economic challenges that young women face as they're trying to come up as leaders. What would you say are other specific challenges and maybe even opportunities associated with this area as they grow into leaders, especially when it comes to inclusive governance?
Well, I do think that women all around the world have a unique set of challenges that they're up against. And, you know, I'm not claiming that Africa is the only place where women and girls need to be more visible in leadership. But I do think across the developing world, you know, tradition to a large extent determines the path that most women's lives take. And I think Africa, you know, any girl growing up in Africa is bombarded with these several voices. And now with the ubiquity of the internet, and you can see what's happening in other countries a little much more easily than before, you know, there's this modern contemporary narrative of you can do anything and be anything and have anything. But then there's the on the ground reality that many of these women and girls face, which is still very much traditionally controlled. Sometimes it's influenced by religious belief systems, cultural practices. It's tempered with, this is just the way things go here. And I think that tension traps a lot of women and girls thinking, you know, the path of progress to leadership isn't for people that look like me. Because the easiest way that people still people's power is by making them feel like they have none. And a lot of women and girls in Africa are growing up in spaces where they are made to feel powerless. So part of what I know and have seen works is, number one, we have to meet women and girls where they are, which is why, you know, I like to focus a lot of our work in communities that have strong religion and culture, because I realize that it is both a hurdle, but it's also an opportunity. So for example, in Ghana, over 70% of the population, at least according to our census, professes Christianity. That means majority of the women and girls we are serving are Christians. And it's been powerful. And in 2013, I actually wrote a book, my first book, which was drawing leadership lessons from a biblical story in the book of Numbers, chapter 27. And using that as a tool to demonstrate that, you know, you might have been taught from your pulpit that women aren't supposed to be in leadership, but there are several examples in your holy book that suggest otherwise. And it's been a powerful tool to use to help bring aha moments and bring confidence to women who feel like their religion does not allow them to be publicly in charge of anything. And to use a text that they already adhere to and a religious framework that they already trust to empower them has been such a tool that has been successful for us to use, that when we challenge them to read scriptures for themselves and read about the women in the Bible and some of the amazing things that they accomplished. In Numbers 27, for example, that specific story that I wrote about is a story of five sisters who got together and were able to overthrow an unjust law. They went to the leader of the time and said, "This law is not fair and we would like it changed." And they went through a process and eventually got what they wanted. So that's been powerful. And similarly, we've been doing that with texts like the Quran for women who are Muslim. But number one, we meet women where they are. If they're religious and culturally inclined, we want to meet them there. We want to take elements from their religion or their culture and help them see that they too can and should hone their power and to make impact in the community that they're in. I think the second thing I'm noticing is that helping women better understand systems is part of how you help women reclaim their power. Because I think we've got a generation of young people that have tools to make noise about what's wrong, but not all of them actually have the knowledge base to proffer solutions to make it correct. So we've got a lot of activist young people that complain bitterly about politics online, but don't really understand how to affect political change. And that's why our governance program is really important to me, because it's about helping young people understand this is what the Constitution states. These are the powers that are vested in these institutions. Oh, actually, what you're complaining about isn't in the purview of that office. It's in the purview of this one. And this is how you can lodge a complaint more formally. This is how you build consensus. This is how you spur change by following these strategic steps as opposed to the public venting and complaining, which we're good at. And it does have its place, but that's where passion needs to be met with strategy. And then lastly, I think that there's something to be said about empowering young people to use their voices. I think that especially because technological advances and, you know, the effect of AI and all of these things, these shifts that are, you know, affecting the way the world works and the way we do work and the way we vote and the way we consume information. I really think we have to be deliberate about creating space for young people to share what they know with us who are older. See, I've always maintained that true success comes from your circles of influence. And I do think, you know, you need a circle of people behind you because they start to adapt new technologies more quickly than you do. They see the world through a completely new vantage point than you do. I believe my work with young people keeps me young, keeps me innovative, keeps me informed and clued in, that there is a pouring in that we do to the younger, but they also pour into us as well. And I think treating younger generations with the respect that wisdom can be and is found in their generation could really help us benefit from their brilliance. Because a lot of young people feel so disregarded, unappreciated, relegated to the sidelines. They feel like tokens more than they feel like people. And I think a lot of governments, a lot of companies, and especially a lot of communities could derive the untapped benefit that young people possess if we would pay closer attention to what they're saying. And not dismiss it with this idea that we've been around longer than you have, and so we know better than you do. I do think that there is this unique wisdom that's unlocked from the young. Yeah. And the older generations that will go further and be more effective will be those that listen, which is why I do encourage the young people in my networks. You know, I mentor both women and young men as well. I mean, I think at heart, I'm a leader developer. It's not necessarily gender-based, although I do have a soft spot for women. But I do encourage the young people that I have influence over to not be afraid to share their ideas, even if they sound stupid, and to be willing to continue to do the thought work, to tinker and to try. Because if we continue to relegate and desecrate the wisdom that comes out of the young, they'll stop trying, which means we'll stop having innovation, which means we can't go as far as we could if we would listen. So those are kind of the three things that feel important to me, that we've got to meet people where they are. We've got to give them the tools to do the work and get out of their way. And we've got to listen, because some of the best ideas, the most profitable ideas, are actually with those, are with those behind us.
Yeah, and especially with listening, I think both generations could learn a lot from each other. Because sometimes young people may not have the best of ideas. They may have, they may need that guidance from older generations so that we can all move as a continent, all move forward together. What are some notable success stories or initiatives that have emerged from your work? You did mention earlier on that you have about 1,200 success stories from Leading Ladies Network.
We have over 12,000 success stories from 8 African countries and counting. We have a number of women who've run for political office. Some have been successful, some not. We've got women and girls who have, you know, risen through the ranks of their companies, started and launched companies. And, you know, this growing network of women and girls is really, really my pride and joy. These are people who honed their voices, who found and discovered their internal power and haven't looked back. And I think, as I think about what the next 15 years could or should look like, I really think about how to leverage new tools to reach more women. You know, we're investing a lot of time and effort in digitizing a lot of our learning so that no matter where women are, they can access some of our content and take courses and really, really learn and grow wherever it is they are. It's been powerful to pilot some of this since COVID, from 2020 till now. We've been in beta testing of our Standout Women's Leadership Academy, which is a cohort-based program that, you know, and it's women from all over the world. It's not even just Africa taking, you know, courses together, growing and learning together. We currently have a wellness program that we're in the first stages of. We've got 40 women from 6 countries, 2 of them outside of Africa, who said yes to this, wellness program that we're really teaching, not just the academic stuff or the technical stuff, but also the soft stuff like self-care, like diet and nutrition and exercise, and what are some of the strategies we can employ to make sure that the rest of our lives is the best of our lives. And, you know, I feel so enriched by that, because I want our work to meet women holistically, not just professional, but also, you know, in their health and in their wellness and in the impact that they have on society. You know, some of the women in our network began with us when they were in junior high, and now they're parents and they have kids and they're, you know, successful entrepreneurs or business owners, or they are CEOs. And now they're being, you know, attacked by lifestyle diseases, you know, things like that. And we should care about that, because they're at the stage where Africa needs them. They shouldn't be dealing with sickness and disease. So that's why I felt very strongly about innovating around that too. So a lot of our work has been iterative, listening to the needs of our customers, you know, these ladies and young girls that trust us with their time, but also trying to answer the question of who does Africa need? What kind of woman does Africa need? And work from there. Like, we want to be responsible for putting women in state houses, you know, the seats of government in parliament and in the front lines of business? And what will it take? Part of what it will take is that they need to be well. They need to understand the link between, you know, lifestyle choices and disease. They need to be well. And that's why, you know, we started doing programming that at the beginning sounded so absurd. But we need women to be whole, holistically well, and holistically armed to be successful at whatever it is they are called to do. And so that's why, you know, we're back at the drawing board here at year 15 to say, how do we make sure we remain relevant to women in our space? And how do we make sure that those women themselves remain relevant to their spaces? You know, and part of it is this re-emphasizing on, you know, holistic wellness, on, you know, connecting them to each other, on providing more advisory and strategic support. So we've invested more in our executive coaching arm so that more women who need strategic and technical help can find the coaching support that they need to maintain a high altitude performance as they rise higher through their ranks. We need confidentiality, you know, and that kind of advisory support where no one needs to know that we're involved, but we're solidly involved in supporting. And the final piece of this is, you know, financial support. And that's why I really love what the team is doing at Angaza. You know, I love that the vision for a manifesto for women's financial inclusion on the continent. I love that, you know, the Angaza Award is really focusing on highlighting and showcasing women who are paving the way innovatively in the finance sector in Africa. Because as your founder said, Nuru said something along the lines of, money really is the lifeblood. And many women are settling for abusive relationships or are, you know, stagnated in their political careers or not able to just move to their next level because of money. And so that really is something we are prioritizing in our next phase as an organization, that we want women to not just be knowledgeable, but we want them to be financially resourced so that they can, you know, more easily pursue their ambitions and their goals. And with financial freedom, you know, avoid the pitfalls that come with exposure, because I really believe that our fundamental job as Leading Ladies Network is to prepare women for prominence, women to be on the front lines of wherever it is they are called to. And to prepare for prominence, I think a big piece of that is your financial stability, having a plan in place to make sure that you can thrive financially as you say yes to a public service career that may not pay you as much, having, you know, the resources within to run for office, which is becoming increasingly expensive, no matter what country or geography you're in, and having the resources to take care of yourself so that you don't become another victim or tragic statistic. You know, when I did a lot of HIV/AIDS work, I think I was appalled, but also, you know, my heart was pricked by the number of women and girls who were contracting diseases because, you know, they just needed to eat that day. So they didn't care much about protecting themselves for disease. They just really needed a meal. And as long as someone could guarantee them a meal, they would let them do whatever to their bodies and plant sickness in them because of economics. So if we can fix the economic issue and empower more women financially and economically, it's part of how we help prepare them for future prominence, because we take one of the biggest hurdles out of the way.
Definitely looking forward to the next 15 years of Leading Ladies Network. It sounds like a lot is going to be done to empower our future leaders. I'd like us to now talk about your book, The Leading Lady, which has been described as a practical and actionable advice for women and girls who want to develop their leadership skills. Could you kindly walk us through the inspiration behind the book and walk us through the creative process you underwent while writing it?
Sure. The Leading Lady Way is a book that chronicles some of my personal journey, but also the organization's journey and the key leadership lessons that I feel can empower the next generation of women as leaders. You know, I like practical more than theoretical. So I, you know, whether my first book, The Daughters of Zelophehad, or this second book, The Leading Lady Way, I really want to give people actionable steps. And, you know, I illustrate that with anecdotes that really illustrate some of what I believe are some of the key things that any woman that is negotiating a rise into leadership needs to be aware of. And so the process for me was really digging in to my own journey and the journeys of women that I've had the opportunity to mentor and coach or be mentored or coached by. So the back of the book, I've got some specific stories of women that have been in my network that I was inspired by. But throughout the chapters, I really, really talk about, you know, what I think every woman needs to know in order to prepare for prominence. And I open up the chapter or the book with a chapter that really underscores my fundamental belief about everyone, meaning everyone is essentially who they need to be to do what God has called them to do in the world. So I'm not a big believer in, you know, kind of comparing yourself with someone else and thinking, I got to be like them. I think in essence, we are all who we need to be. So that first chapter is really about self-acceptance and about helping women to accept that you are who you are, and that's exactly who you're meant to be. So when you accept that, then you can build and hone the skill set around your strengths as opposed to agonizing around what you don't have. Because I truly believe that there's no such thing as a lack of resources. It's a lack of resourcefulness. That you've got everything that you need to be the best you. You just haven't looked at it the right way. So I really, you know, sought to write a book that if people did not interact with me personally or our work as an organization, they could take up this book and just absorb the key beliefs and the key practices that I think really launches women into leadership. So that's what the book's about. That's why I felt very, you know, inspired to write it. And the process for me was just really a reflective process. What has worked in my life and in the lives of women that I've had the opportunity to serve, or in the women that have served me and mentored or coached or counseled me. And I put that together into what I believe will be a transformative guidebook for any woman, especially women in the global South that are looking to emerge as public leaders and prepare themselves for prominence.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. A key takeaway from me is when you said that passion is good, but strategy is better. I definitely will be implementing that in my own career moving forward. And the fact that we need to meet women where they are, that is such an important aspect to empowering each other and empowering young girls in their careers and in leadership. Are there any more points that you would like to add before we wrap up?
I would love to round up by talking, and this is another chapter in my book, The Leading Lady Way. You cannot be your best self by yourself. I do not believe that we were designed for isolation or to do everything by ourselves. And I think one of the key things that I see in the lives of women who are struggling to be their best selves is that they're trying to do it by themselves. So I believe in mentorship and in coaching and in counseling, investing in those relationships that will enable you to go further quickly so that you don't spend too much time navigating issues and challenges. You learn how to ask for help. In my first book, The Daughters of Zelophehad, I talked about the fact that I have a threefold strategy that I recommend every woman uses. Ask for help, pray for help, but pay for help as well. So get comfortable with paying to be helped. pay to take a class or pay to be coached or pay, you know, there are solutions to every problem you've got. So be comfortable asking for them, be comfortable paying for them as well, because you were not meant to succeed by yourself. So you can't be your best self by yourself is really the parting comment I want to make, because a lot of women who reach out to me, you know, talk about their issues, and I realize that it's because they're trying to go at success alone. They're trying to do it all, learn it all, be it all. And I found that one of the ways that you shortcut your way to success is by understanding this principle that you cannot be your best self by yourself. So surround yourself. Don't be afraid to ask for help, but also have the discipline to pay for it as well, because that gets you much more further and much more faster. Thank you.
Thank you once again, and we look forward to hearing from you at the Angaza Forum on the 16th and 17th of October in Nairobi.
I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
For more information about the Angaza Forum, visit www.angazaforums.com. You can also interact with us on LinkedIn and X at Angaza Forum.